we've come to this strange place where silence is something we have to create, or we have to carve out space for. And I carve out space every morning. I have to force myself to do it every single day. Because somehow, even though we need this, you know, it's not, it doesn't come naturally to seek it.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight we are graced with the presence of not one, but two remarkable individuals. Krista Tippett and David White are going to share with us their ideas, their writing, their wit, and hopefully the fruits of the wisdom they've gleaned thus far on their respective journeys. In these turbulent times, Americans appear more restless than ever in their search for meaning, for anchorage, for some sign of spiritual purpose or direction. Who would have guessed that in our high-tech culture there could be such a hunger for this discussion, ways of being in the world? Krista Tippett represents the ballast voice of reason and calm on the NPR airwaves. For the past 10 years, her program On Being has grown from strength to strength. And in 2014, President Obama awarded her the National Humanities Medal for thoughtfully delving into the mysteries of human existence. I won't belabor my introduction to David, who is a man of great industry and varied talent, which includes his internationally regarded poetry and prose. But in order to expedite matters and to maximize our time with the speakers, I will segue using Krista's own words. Poetry slows you down. And anything in our world now that slows us down is to be valued. So we embrace this opportunity and welcome Krista and David.
I was thinking it might be good to open the conversation up, because I think the kinds of conversations I've always been having about what matters and about what it means to be human and about who we are to each other feels so much more resonant. I set out to interrogate wisdom as a matter that is acquired in any life, but I think that this matter of becoming wise is a challenge for us now to do together and to accompany each other. And it feels so much, it's always good to be in, you know, even in our technological age. I mean, Mary, you said, I think especially in our technological age, we want to think about these things. But it's always good to be in a room full of people speaking about things that are truly meaningful. But it just feels that much more necessary and life-giving now.
You alluded to this in the book, that humor was high on your list of virtues.
Yeah, no, a sense of humor is a virtue. A wise person has a sense of humor. The whole notion of virtues, which is so magnetic to me, and I find to be very magnetic to millennials, to new generations of people coming up, I find it to be problematic sometimes for people of a certain age who associate virtues kind of with the kind of rules that I got from my grandfather, when virtue is about things you're probably doing wrong, whether you know it or not. And I see virtue, I think of virtues as spiritual technologies. I mean, this is what we cultivate to become, right? You said we can cultivate a beautiful life. You don't necessarily have to be born patient or compassionate or kind. These are things we can practice, and we're learning through neuroscience that what we practice, we become, and that goes for character as much as it goes for other kinds of skills. Now, I don't know, a sense of humor, that's a little bit harder to learn. But what I do know is that it is absolutely a common denominator. And the reason that's important is because I also think a problem with talking about virtue is that it can sound so serious and like a penance and something very earnest. And the truth is, this is a better way to live. This is a more joyful way to live. And it does include an ability to laugh at yourself and an ability to laugh. That is not optional.
Well, one would say we really have great reason for mirth at this point in the country, more than ever before, need for mirth. And in fact, this is another point you raised.
It's actually been a great period for satire.
Oh, for satire, yes.
We have some great comedy now that we didn't have before.
One other quote which really impressed me was you said, again, talking about the traits of people that are wise and things that you value, was to have the courage to be vulnerable in front of those we passionately disagree with. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, couldn't be more of an antithesis than the current situation we find ourselves in. Could you both speak to that?
Well, I think following the path of vulnerability is actually one of the great diagnostic features of an artistic discipline. And we're constantly associating vulnerability with weakness. But in artistry, you create a robust vulnerability, yeah. And vulnerability comes from vulneras, the Latin meaning wound, and it really is looking at the way you are open to the world, whether you want to be or not. Yeah, and we have this strange notion that you can create a life or a métier, a work, a vocation, or a relationship where you will not be vulnerable. Yeah? And we have the same parallel illusion around heartbreak. I think. This new relationship you have, at last I found a person who will not break my heart. Yeah. Now I'm sorry, you've chosen them out unconsciously for that very core competency. They will break your heart. Yeah. And when you think about it, there is no path a human being can take sincerely without having their heart broken. Relationship will do it right away. And then when you think about even the longest marriage has had its heart broken many times just to stay together. And then you look at parenting. There's never been a mother or father since the beginning of time who hasn't had their heart broken by their child. And they don't have to do anything dramatic to do it. But usually they do. Yes. And they live with you as spies and saboteurs for years. Yeah? Spying out your every psychological weakness. You know? Until one day in the kitchen when they're about 14 years old, when you have your back turned to them, usually when you are making something for them, the emotional stiletto is placed in exactly the right place. And as you feel it go in, you say, how did you know exactly where to place it? And they say, I've been watching you for a good few years. In vocation and leadership, you know, a professional area where we hope to be armored, we often go to work in order to be immune from the emotional vulnerabilities of other kinds of relationship. But if you're in a leadership position, you are already vulnerable. Yeah? I'm often working out in Asia, you know, and the great question is, what about losing face? I always say, if you're in a leadership position, you have already lost face. Yeah? Everybody who works for you already knows your flaws and weaknesses. In fact, you could walk up to any one of them and say, what's my biggest weakness? And they would tell you right away. And you would say, could you just hesitate for a moment, you know? I mean, take some time to think about it, you know? No, I know what it is. And you walk over here, you ask this other, but they say exactly the same thing. Yeah? You have already been seen. It's just like being a parent. You have already lost face. Yeah? Just by being human, we are already vulnerable. We live in emotional, physical bodies that are subject to powers that are greater than our own, yeah? Including the invitation to our own disappearance. So the only choice we have really is to be generous citizens of loss. Yeah? Mm. The only choice we have is how we inhabit our vulnerability. So this is a beautiful and disturbing question, actually. How do I inhabit my vulnerability, or do I just try to run away from it all the time? Do I ever try to speak from a robustly vulnerable place? If you do try and speak from a robustly vulnerable place, you are speaking from a place which is the acme of and essence of poetry, really, the attempt to create these languages against which we have no defenses. Mm. If you think about it in a romantic or in a marriage, the conversation ends when vulnerability ends. Where there's no vulnerability in the conversation, there is actually no conversation. And it's just different forms of vulnerability in different parts of our life. And in the workplace, the vulnerability is usually just me refusing to have all the easy answers as the boss, you know, or as a person contributing to the enterprise. So. Vulnerability.
So, you know, that line is from Francis Kissling, who has taught me a great deal about conversation across difference and relationship with difference. And she was the head of Catholics for Choice and a very renowned and passionate pro-choice advocate. And then when she left that position, and she did that for 25 years, she was called the abortion queen by her critics. So she was staunchly associated with a certain side of a certain issue. And when she left that, she decided that what she wanted to pursue was what it would mean to be in real relationship with her political opposites, which is not necessarily about being ready to have your mind changed or going in to change someone's mind, but what would it mean to be in relationship?
Amen.
And one of the things she learned is that if you really are going to be in relationship and change, if not how you relate to the issue, how you live together forward, one of the things you have to do is be able to become vulnerable in the presence of those with whom you disagree. But what I want to add, and I think it's an important thing to add right now, is we have to create spaces where it would be reasonable and trustworthy for us or someone else to come in and be vulnerable. So that's not a place you start. It's a place you get to. And in our culture, getting to that place of vulnerability with those with whom we disagree is going, and I think we have to, but it's going to require the creation of new kinds of conversational spaces. And I mean physical spaces, but I also, you know, I just think when we think about the media spaces or political spaces with which we're most familiar, that wouldn't be reasonable. It wouldn't be advisable. But it is absolutely possible. And I think we have to all take it upon ourselves in our places to figure out how to issue that invitation and, again, create that space, whatever that means, for that to happen.
Well, the big question in the book, which I'm not going to pose because it's the book, really, and you raise the question, what are we for?
Yeah.
And you say this is a seminal question for young people to consider. What are we for? So maybe you have to read the book to get the answer to that one. But do you want to kick that around before we open it?
Yeah, well, I think that is what are we for as opposed to what do we do, which is the question and the identity that Americans rush to. It's part of our strength, but it actually inhibits us from bringing all of our strength and all of our character to being present to the world with all of that. You know, I think this was a problem of the 20th century. It was very much about accomplishment. It was about large exterior life and exterior presentation, and interior life was optional. I actually felt like the 2016 presidential election was that on steroids. It makes perfect sense to me that we had, you know, two of the oldest candidates running for president ever. And I think there's such a contrast between that model of what it means to be powerful and what I feel new generations aspiring to, in fact, insisting on. But they are going to have to create those realities to inhabit.
Well, I would like to welcome anybody who would like to pose a question to come up to the microphone.
I want to hear the question about the conversation that we have in sexuality, not just spirituality, but that intersection. And you ask people about their upbringing, and you talk about love, and your conversations are so intimate. And I'm always missing that one little question, like, tell me about your sexuality. And so I'm not asking you to ask those questions, but I'm kind of asking for you to tell me, in all of this
about
exploration of embodiment, spirituality, understanding, and conversation, where we are with that piece.
Well, I think it's the ultimate interaction between spirituality and physicality. And it is not merely physical.
No.
But I think it's too big a subject to get into. Also, you know, it was hard enough for me to do spirituality on public radio. And if I said I'm going to do sex as well, we did a show just a couple of weeks ago with Alain de Botton on love and relationships.
Yeah.
And also last year or the year before, I did a show with Helen Fisher, who's she's like the chief scientist at Match.com. And we talked about sexuality and the biochemistry. And it's very discouraging because basically, I mean, she said it is literally in the brain. Well, not sexuality in general, but that first rush, that in-loveness, is essentially a form of insanity, of temporary insanity. But Alain de Botton comes along and rescues us and says, compatibility is not a precondition for love, but an accomplishment of love. So it's what you do after all that beautiful chemical cocktail wears off.
Well, I just, my last book was a book of love poetry, actually. It's called The Sea in You. It's about the whole tidal seasonal meeting, which is physical, psychological. And I was a little shy to read those poems to begin with. But it's interesting to work your way into them, become comfortable in public, having this very, very erotic experience, you know, on stage. But it's super personal. It's super. It's the way we meet the seasonality and changeability of the world, and the seasonality and changeability of another person's body. It's that breathing in and out. It's the meeting, the conversation. Yeah. That's all I'll say about it for now. So thank you.
Thank you both for this wonderful conversation. Krista, I had a question for you. I've really loved listening to the conversations you've had. I think what draws me most to them is this inclination that I think many people in this audience have, that, you know, we can connect with anybody of any background, of any space, of any interest, if we are vulnerable, and if we ask these generous questions, as you said. And for me, that's been a very kind of deep principle with which I want to live in this world. Mm. Lately, that's been difficult to kind of move by. And I think this is in two dimensions. One is kind of the obvious dimension of people with whom you have very different political ideologies, where I used to believe that if I just showed up and I was vulnerable and I showed them who I was as a human being, we could engage in a productive conversation. So that seems to not be true in many spaces, and that's been quite a shock for me. The other shock that I think is much more difficult for me to deal with, and I was hoping you might have some insights into this, is people with the same political ideologies, the same social inclinations, but where we seem to reach a wall in empathy, where the question is, has your personhood ever been questioned? Has your identity as an American or as a human being ever been questioned? And I think different people live different experiences, but for some, that is a question that comes up all the time, and for some, that is perhaps a question that has never come up. And that's where the empathy is really hard to kind of pull out. I feel like I hit a wall, no matter how vulnerable both sides are. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's clear, but I was wondering if you have faced that in your own conversations, and if you have, you know, advice for that.
This question of your own your own identity feeling in question and people not being able to understand that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the experience of not being a full American or a full person,
right,
based on your perceived identity.
Yes. Yeah, this is really hard. It's a hard moment. Part of what we have to do right now is just take that in. You know, again, this kind of can-do spirit of Americans, we'll power through this, we'll duke it out. This is not going to work for us. I mean, there's so much emotion out on the surface all around. I think the point you're making about it's just as difficult in circles where you feel you should be known and understood. And I hear a lot of people talking about feeling as alienated within their families as they do within society at large. And it's actually, those are the most challenging places. I think we have to be kind to ourselves. And I think that's the first thing I have to say. And you have to protect yourself. Like, I think that that if you're truly vulnerable in the sense that you can get hurt or you can feel hurt, you don't have to put yourself into that situation. Sometimes that's the best way to love other people, is to step back. And you know, in regular times, when there's not a crisis or a trauma, just even like in family life, what is normal family life? There's no such thing. But in family life, I mean, this is something we actually possess a lot of intelligence from the experiences we have in our intimate circles that we could apply to the larger matter of our life together. Because we know in our families or in our circles of friends, you know, people we've known forever, or coworkers with whom we spend every day, people we love, people we're in relationship with, there are times and people with whom we are just completely in sync and they get us. And there are also, within those circles, there's huge diversity. And there are people who drive us crazy, and there are people with whom over long periods of time we manage to stay in relationship because we are clear what we will not talk about with them. And that's not to be in denial or to be failing. I think that's what I would say about that. And right now, we just have to give this some time. We have to kind of take one step forward at a time and have the conversations we can have. And there may be some conversations, if your identity feels threatened, somebody else needs to be in that room having that conversation, not you. And I feel like we all have to figure out what our calling is in this moment. And I feel that my calling, a simple way to put it, is to be a calmer of fear and to point at generative possibilities and the way we get there. I think some of us are called to throw our bodies between people who are vulnerable, feel threatened, are threatened, you know, or to be the ones in that room having that particular exchange. It's not a cop-out.
Thank you. So much of what each of you offer is rooted in language and this output of communication, whether it be through writing or through the conversations you have or some of both. And so I wonder for each of you in the process of articulating beauty and calling out beauty in the experiences and minds of other people, what the role of silence is for you as a practice in your lives, in your relationships.
Yeah, we often equate silence with stillness, but actually in my experience it's seasonal and tidal. You know, it's actually moving into the seasonal aspects of your own body, your own physical presence. All of the great meditational disciplines around silence always have you suddenly either focusing on the breath or naturally becoming aware of it, you know, this easy give and take. And I've sat in many a Zen retreat in my life, and it's always astonishing. You don't realize until about 3 days in how much effort and will you've been putting into breathing. Yeah? Even though we have this autonomous nervous system which will take care of it. If you leave it alone, you will just breathe. Yeah? But we're constantly overriding something that is actually dwelling at this frontier of exchange. Yeah? And so to me, silence is this radical letting alone. Yeah? Letting alone of yourself, of your mind, of your body, of the threshold you're on right now, so that it can speak back to you in its own words, its own form. Yeah? And so that's the same equivalent in writing, that it's this radical letting alone so you can be spoken back to and you can create this live conversation that other people can then join. Yeah. So silence is this radical clearing act. These timeless elements of making a conversation real. I mentioned earlier the first one, which is stopping the conversation you're having now. This immediately puts you into a relationship with the unknown and with silence. Yeah. So then the beautiful question is, what is my relationship to silence? Am I deeply uncomfortable with it? Well, we're living in a time where we're becoming almost allergic to silence. We're so addicted to our gadgets and so addicted to the internet and to input that we start to feel a kind of physical decomposition, you know, when we stop being attached to this constant input at the surface. Yeah? So the silence is the invitation to drop down to this other place. Where there's another relationship with time. You know, and in the great meditative traditions, this is where you start to have an experience of the eternal, where the eternal is not an endless amount of time, but a place outside of time, where time actually seems to be radiating out from the place where you're standing. And to my mind, this is the only place where human beings are not afraid of death, is when they're experiencing this timeless frontier. And that comes through cultivating silence. Silence is a beautiful question.
Yeah, that we have. We're in this strange. We've come to this strange place where silence is something we have to create, or we have to carve out space for. And I carve out space every morning to kind of do a combination of meditation and prayer and a little bit of reading, contemplative reading, and I have to force myself to do it every single day, because somehow, even though we need this, you know, it's not it doesn't come naturally to seek it. I'm fascinated by how, you know, monasteries and retreat centers are filling up with modern people seeking silence. Like, we're rediscovering our need for this, and sometimes wisdom emerges through learning something new, through the acquisition of enlightenment, and sometimes wisdom is about rediscovering things we always knew and forgot, and that we need silence is one of those things. Right there alongside real food, right?
Thank you.
You've been listening to Ways of Being in the World, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square in March 2017 with Krista Tippett and David White. We are co-sponsored by the Lowell Institute and Friends of the Cambridge Forum. Thank you for joining us, and do come again.